Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks again to everybody. Each week this month, we're talking to Jill Lepore, American history professor at Harvard and staff writer at The New Yorker. She's worked with us to choose four moments in history that shed some light on how we got to the current political and social moment in America. So far, we've talked about the death of newspapers in 1765, the Karen Ann Quinlan right to die case of 1975, the parrot fever panic of 1930, which presaged swine flu, and today the right to strike case of 1898 and Clarence Darrow's defense. Darrow, probably the 20th century's most famous lawyer for the underdog and champion of civil rights, most famous for defending teacher John Scopes, who defied Tennessee law and taught evolution in the classroom, the famous Scopes monkey trial of 1925. But Jill Lepore, in last week's issue of The New Yorker, wrote about a lesser-known case involving the right to strike, a case that Darrow said was the great battle for human liberty. We're still fighting over the rights of workers, only instead of workers in sawmills and garment factories, it's over teachers and other public employees, at least right now. Jill Lepore, welcome back to WNYC for the last segment of this May series. Thanks for all your time this month.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So Wisconsin versus Kidd, the case about a worker strike that turned violent in Oshkosh, Wisconsin in 1898. Tell us the story.
Well, there had been a lot of strife leading up in the years before the strike in 1898, the fallout really from the panic of 1893, which really devastated the economy at the turn of the Gilded Age. A lot of people making a lot of money, a lot of factory owners making a lot of money, a lot of speculation, everything kind of collapsed. And in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, which at the time, second largest city in Wisconsin, a place where four out of five people were immigrants, it's the door-making capital of the world. They just today have dozens of sawmills. They're cranking out doors, you know, hour by hour. And the immigrants in Oshkosh come to see that the owners of the factories are laying off workers and replacing them basically with the workers' children. So in violation of whatever child labor laws there were, which there were not very many at the time, they're taking the opportunity of the excuse of the panic to lay off the adult workforce and replace large numbers of people with the children. So workers go on strike in May of 1898, and the strike is largely organized by a guy from the Amalgamated Woodworkers Union, which is where the trial gets its name. Thomas Kidd comes up from Chicago. Kidd happens to be a friend of Darrow's, so when Kidd is actually tried for the crime of conspiring to destroy the business of a guy named George Payne, who owns one of the largest lumber mills in Oshkosh, Darrow comes up to lead the defense.
And Wisconsin brought the National Guard in after a strikebreaker cracked the skull of a 16-year-old striking employee. Darrow took the case to defend Kidd, who in his efforts to organize the workers was charged, as you say, with conspiracy to destroy the business. Who won?
Well, Darrow won the case. The woodworkers didn't really win the argument in the sense that they didn't form a union until the 1930s. Darrow had this reputation for great drama in the courtroom and great success in the courtroom, which is why the union raised a lot of money. They didn't hold a pledge drive, but they raised money to hire him. And he turned the money down and said, you know, I'll represent Kidd so long as you print my closing argument as a pamphlet. Because Darrow was a great showman, and he wanted to get a lot of attention to the cause of labor and also to improve his own career. So he won the case in the end, not really arguing that Kidd hadn't actually initiated the strike or that Kidd wasn't the leading force behind the strike, but simply by arguing that that it was constitutionally irresponsible for the state of Wisconsin to argue that there was no right to strike.
So did the case, in effect, help to establish a right to strike?
Well, the right to strike existed. It was in a certain kind of way. Some people at the time, especially in the labor movement, might not have minded if Darrow had lost and then they had been able to appeal. It would have been interesting at that point to bring the case to the Supreme Court to actually test this claim, because some states, not just Wisconsin, were really quite interested in pushing to its limit the argument that labor does not have the right to strike. So the fact that Darrow won it in a certain kind of way was not the greatest victory for the labor movement.
Of course, Wisconsin's labor issues are in the news again today. following the lawmaking public sector collective bargaining, outlawing collective bargaining, which was signed this March by Republican Governor Scott Walker for the public sector unions. The teachers' unions are often the big bad wolf in these budget debates, and public workers are getting squeezed in every state in the country in the state fiscal crises these days. Is there a line from Wisconsin versus Kidd to Scott Walker versus the teachers, or are they just so different that you can't even draw a connection?
Well, they are really different. And, you know, the great error of historical punditry is the false analogy. That's what you hear all the time when pundits offer up earlier episodes in American history to illuminate our current day problems. So you always want to be careful about that, and just the way your question is careful about that problem. I do think, though, that one of the things that, you know, Dara was arguing at the time is that, or what he argued and why he was so effective in the courtroom, because he was a great orator, was situating that trial in the context of a kind of centuries-long struggle for liberty. Like, this is why Dara always won, right? You need just with this, this is the most important trial ever in the history of mankind. This was basically his argument, because what we're looking at here in Oshkosh in 1898 is the powerless facing the powerful, and Darrow argued that there was a conspiracy in Oshkosh, but it was a conspiracy of businessmen to deprive, to earn the greatest profit at the cost of the lives and health of their workers. So in a large sense, in a kind of meta sense, of course, like, that debate continues, right? Whose interests are at stake when we are making arguments about prosperity versus arguments about equality? Are we all likely to profit by the prosperous becoming most prosperous? This is a kind of like a Reagan-esque trickle-down economics, which was an argument of the Gilded Age robber barons. Or do we need to fight hard for legal protections that that enshrine equality and make possible economic equality that the capitalist market will always be exerting a force against? So in that kind of broad, big history of struggle, sure, what's going on now is absolutely related. It's not derivative of it, and it's not parallel to it, but it is part of a, you know, centuries-long reconfiguration of arguments about rights and obligations with regard to economic prosperity.
Darrow was just full of these quotes. All jury trials, he said, are contests between the rich and the poor. Was that a compelling framing to people at that time? People today might take that as hyperbole.
You know, it was compelling at the time when Darrow said it. That's what's unusual about Darrow, right? Because other more strident and shrill spokespeople for socialism. I mean, Darrow wasn't actually a socialist, but he was sympathetic with socialism. He was opposed to socialism just because he was opposed to mass movements. But other people that had a similar political philosophy would have been seen as much more squarely radical and even anarchist than Darrow came across. Because one of the things that Darrow does so well in the courtroom is align himself with the jury. I mean, he picks the jury very selectively, but he does make this argument that a jury trial is a trial between the rich and the poor, but he makes the people on the jury feel that they need to be on the side of the poor because being on the side of the poor, I mean, in this instance, he often calls on the language of Christianity. He compares Thomas Kidd again and again and again in the course of this trial to Jesus Christ.
Oh, goodness.
Which, you know, for Darrow, who was you know, the most famous skeptic in American history, and who argued so vehemently against the literal interpretation of the Bible, to deploy Christ, and he would cite the New Testament again and again and again in the courtroom because it worked as a kind of lingua franca for the ordinary juror.
And the vast majority aren't rich, so I guess he could make that argument and get followers. Are there any celebrated lawyers today on par with Darrow? When I think about this, all the well-known lawyers in recent years, the really famous ones, were working for O.J. Simpson. Do people know the lawyers arguing Supreme Court cases today? I mean, you know, maybe a few people know Lawrence Tribe when he did it, or know one or two of the conservatives. But why do you think Darrow captured the popular imagination of the public? Or really, are there Clarence Darrows of today?
If there are, we're not hearing about them. They're not being reported in the same way, for sure. I mean, Darrow, when he represented Big Bill Haywood in a miners' murder trial, that was the first trial covered by the wire services, and Darrow represented him in that murder trial partly for that reason. He filled up the space that was being opened up by wire service. I don't know. I mean, we can think. I'm sure we can think of a lot of defense lawyers, but they're all basically corporate lackeys. They have kind of a national reputation. They're not people struggling on for the interests of the poor. And the argument that is made to the poor about where their interests lie and where their allegiances ought to be now, most effectively, is by people who will tell the poor that their interests are all aligned with the rich. I mean, Darrow's argument is exactly the opposite: to tell the ordinary person, actually, your interests align with the interests of the poor. Most effective in our kind of national political rhetoric lately is exactly the opposite argument, I think, as a matter of rhetorical force. People who stay on message, we see that argument much more often from the right than from, you know, a much more effective on message argument from the right than the left, as everybody has been.
And do we see these kinds of questions fought more in the legislative process than in the courts as compared with 100 years ago?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I think these questions are brought to the courts. There's a lot of interest lately in overturning some of the rulings from the Progressive Era, the Supreme Court rulings from the Progressive Era and the New Deal rulings that set up the, you know, modern regulatory state. So things that Darrow fought for, like the 8-hour day or minimum wage requirements, those were all achieved during the Progressive Era, and they were endorsed by the court or not overturned by the court. And I guess I do think there is a kind of battle going on now to think about how to overturn those things. And the actions of the governor of Wisconsin in barring the right to collective bargaining on the part of public sector employees is part of that effort. So I do think there's a fair amount of movement in these issues right now.
From Wisconsin 100 years ago to Wisconsin today, from Clarence Darrow once upon a time to nobody who we could really identify today, a fascinating history lesson. Ending our four-part weekly series with Jill Lepore, New Yorker staff writer who wrote about this in last week's issue, and American history professor at Harvard. Jill, people have loved these segments. You've just done such a great job articulating the connections between four different episodes in American history and things that we're living with today. So thank you so much from me and from all of our listeners.
It's been a lot of fun.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and still to come, Slate Magazine's Dana Stevens previews the summer movies, part 2.